Okay, this morning we're going to cover the entire subject of communication. And then we're never going to look at it again, so open up your ears and let's roll. The subject of communication consists of these parts. One, the communication line. And two, the two terminals. It is intimately connected with cause and effect. And when you put distance into cause and effect, you get communication. Inevitably. It has this peculiarity. It is a complete duplication if it is a perfect communication. A perfect communication is a perfect duplication. Therefore, an individual is caught between doing a complete duplication of what is communicating to him and being different. And therein lies the entire anxiety of the thetan. It isn't any more or less than that. Simply that a perfect communication is a duplication. And the thetan doesn't want to duplicate this exactly when he's in effect. And as a result, he tries to be different, which winds up in his being unable to duplicate, he thinks. Unwillingness to duplicate a communication is unwillingness to duplicate. An unwillingness to duplicate then makes it necessary to change position in space. In order to keep from duplicating, one has to change position in space if he's being duplicated too. Otherwise, he's got to hold the incoming communication rigidly in some fashion and not be part of it. Or one is a complete chameleon and simply turns into everything that comes his way. Now let's examine communication. Draw you a two-dimensional graph of the subject of communication. Let's put a line down. And at one end of this line, let's put C. That stands for cause. And at the other end of this line, let's put E. And that stands for effect. Now at the C end of the line, let us put also A, capital A. And at the E end of the line, let us put a capital B. Therefore, we have a line AB, one end of which is cause and the other end of which is effect. Now, right below that, let's draw another line and label, and the end of that line, which is B on the first line, let's call it A. And then let's put C there with that A. Now your line goes back over, just parallel to the other line. And where we had an A on the first line, we now have a B on the second line. And we also mark that capital E. This is very easy to disentangle. It's simply two lines. And the right-hand side of the lines, of both lines, have A, C, B, E. And the left-hand side have E, B, A, C. That's very simple, isn't it? Now we've got a two-way communication channel. But there is no reason whatsoever why a communication line has to be in two directions. But you have a graph there of a conversation. Fellow says, hello, he's cause. That's at point A. That's what's known as a dispatch point. Or source point is much better. And he says, hello. And the fellow over here at B says, uh-huh. Well, now that's E, and that's the receipt point. So let's get this real clean here. These are actually source point, receipt point. The exact terms that we're going to use for some time. I mean, they're getting something different than just a descriptive term. All right, the fellow who says, uh-huh, of course, has started in at his end of the line, and now he's cause, and it goes back to the other fellow who is now effect of aha. The first fellow was the effect of hello, and the second fellow is the effect of aha. The first fellow originated hello, and the second fellow originated aha. Now, there's your communication line, working both ways. Why does it work both ways in this particular case? Well, really because you're interested and you've heard a lot about conversation. Well, conversation, I want to make very clear to you, is a two-way communication channel. It's actually two communication systems. A communication system is only this. A communication system is only that first line. A to B, which the A end is cause and the B end is effect. All right, now let's put a click in at New York City. No, let's put a click in Rome. And the communication line is going to Milan. So we get a click at Milan. Now, we might use the same piece of copper wire to put a click in at Milan and get another click at Rome. But that has anything to do with the communication system. That means we're using the same wire twice, or we're using a duplicate system. Therefore, for our purposes, a fellow shooting another fellow is, in essence, communicating with him. See, that's for our purposes. That's perfectly valid. The sun shining upon you is, for our purposes, and by the way, perfectly factually, communicating with them. Now we have ARC. A stands for affinity, R stands for reality, and C stands for communication. ARC, when combined together, give a gradient scale which made up the chart of human evaluation. Now ARC, interwoven in this fashion, give a degree of understanding, what we know as understanding. All mathematics can be worked out from ARC, by the way. It's very, very interesting, but it's just right there, path perfect. But let's take a look at poor old ARC. Now, ARC is very good. If your fellow can't live on the third dynamic worth a nickel without some ARC, and yet at the same time, the most complete ARC there is, the most complete there is one dot complete identification. Now let's just look at that. Now that's a little point of horror. When you realize that someday, a little shiver of horror is going to go through you. The task of the Thetan is to interpose some distance on a communication line. And as long as he can keep some distance on a communication line, you know, not too much distance and not too little distance, he's all right. But when he becomes unable to impose space between two terminals, which is to say two terminals, point A, point B, when he becomes unable to impose some space, or he is unable to limit the space between A and B, you see, either condition, A, B goes zing and gets infinitely long, or infinite distance, or they go smash and collapse together. Well, when he's unable to control this distance, he goes down, on the one hand, toward a complete identification, when there's no distance in there, and on the other hand, why, he goes up toward an infinite difference. Which isn't good either, because then he can't communicate with anything, and so he gets entirely lost. So when his inabilities become great, he either gets entirely lost, which you call a dispersal case, or the two terminals collapse, and he gets entirely identified, which is your valence case. Okay? All right, now what else is this communication line good for? Well, believe me, it's good to solve every case you run into. Just that little graph, A and B. Because also, this thing is an electric motor. Essentially, an electric motor has two electrodes. in it, two terminals in it. And one of them communicates with the other, and then that one communicates back again. And as they go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, mechanically having distance imposed upon them, actually, they generate an electrical current. So the fellow is having trouble with communications, is also having trouble with terminals, so his haddingness is all shot. And a fellow who can't exteriorize is having terminal trouble. One kind and another. Now you understand that one fellow could be having trouble with one peanut whistle worth of stray energy, and the other fellow begins to have trouble with 100,000 volts of stray energy. But it doesn't matter then what your force of the individual is, or power, or anything of the sort. Just because he can't get out of his head has nothing to do with his power potential. As a matter of fact, in this universe, it works quite the reverse. The fellow who fights, he gets himself into a smashed-down condition pretty easily. All right, what's this all about? Actually, I've told you practically all there is to know about communication. There really isn't anything else to know about communication. But let's look at valences, and let's look at terminals a little bit. Let's find out that the star Sirius, shining upon us, then is conveying to us a message called Sirius. See, the star Sirius shining upon us conveys that message. Now, in order to receive it utterly, we actually, some portion of our beingness, must duplicate Sirius. Must do an exact direction reversal duplication. You see that? An exact direction reversal duplication. You know these people who have direction reversals? Right to left and left to right? They've been communicated with a little too seriously. No pun intended. You see how that would be? Because point B is always a mirror image of point A. This is so much so that actually, if you were to turn the dot and dash around and inspect them, you would find out that they were arriving backwards on a telegraph line. But because they are occupying different intervals of time, you don't notice this. You know, send a dot, it's a dot. Doesn't matter whether it's backwards or frontwards. You send a dash, it's a dash. It still doesn't matter whether it's backwards or frontwards because you've entered in your time element. But if we send an instantaneous impulse down this telegraph line, why, the electronic picture is in reverse if it arrives at the other end. And so it is with somebody standing up facing a group. He says to this group, all right, now your left hand. And, of course, that's his right hand. And so he has to reverse his directions in order to give directions to the group. See, because he's communicating with them. So his image, actually, is arriving in reverse. Now, it not only arrives in reverse, but it arrives upside down. Well, why would it arrive upside down? That is a very mysterious thing. And yet the Thetan has an awful lot of trouble with images arriving upside down. And quite often, when he comes out of his head, it will smash against the ceiling. He's got his gravity in reverse. See, just because it arrives reverse in a horizontal plane, then doesn't mean that this law gets excused in the vertical plane. It actually doesn't. He's just right side up, he happens to be, that's all. Now, you follow, when you look this over, the best way to look this over, I've lost you a little bit there, but the best way to look this over is to demonstrate that the image reverses itself at its receipt point, and you're so accustomed to thinking of this reversal as occurring only in the horizontal plane because you live on Earth where everything is parallel that way that you don't realize the degree of flexibility. Now, what you're actually communicating with an individual, his head and his feet, you see, and your head and feet happen to be in the same vertical plane, whereas your right and left side are not in the same. You see, they are reversed. Well, we'd have to get some cards and show you how this works out. But it's terribly unimportant. What is important is the fact that you find most of your preachers have a direction reversal. They'll stammer for a minute. They'll start to go to the right before they go to the left. And this is so marked that if you were to put a sensitive electronic meter on a steering wheel, you'd demonstrate there that you'd show clearly that every driver, when he starts to turn left, does a tiny little flick impulse to go to the right before he turns left. In other words, his training is a little bit deeper. It's a little bit stimulus response. This is very peculiar. You watch a company of soldiers and so forth, and they have been drilled one way or the other. Well, of course, this driver, as a child, was taught in a schoolroom, so anything he's taught, he tends to get backwards. I hate to hang that on you as a necessity. It isn't a necessity. It is merely a symptom of how deeply stimulus response the GE has become. Has very little to do, actually, with the state of beingness of the faith. But the fellow's body is in a motor report with all other bodies. GE is in a motor report, and the GE gets it backwards. Now, the Thetan doesn't get it backwards. But the Thetan's got to smash through all these stimulus response mechanisms in order to get an action. Therefore, a Thetan just purely and clearly directing out of whole cloth an untrained puppet. If the puppet's in good condition, and if the Thetan is looking, and he's quite alert, and he isn't depending on any automaticities, can make an almost instantaneous reaction on the part of the puppet. But the more stimulus response we enter in to the puppet, why, the less instantaneous reaction there is. And so we get communication lag. And communication lag is that degree to which the Thetan is depending upon the automaticity of the body. And that is communication lag. Now, while your boy is interiorized, you start to give him SOPHC, and you find out he slows way down. Now, if you exteriorize him, you'll find out that this condition is not quite so bad. And then goes away quite rapidly. And the first thing you know, boy, you can check him through the darndest things, and you just get pang, 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 there's nothing to it. See what's happening there? While he's interiorized, he is getting upscale, and therefore more and more instantaneous, and he simply starts plowing through old tangled networks and making direct connections. And as soon as he starts to do this, he starts to knock out the stimulus response system he has to control the body like mad. As a consequence, his reaction time gets faster and faster and faster on SOPHC. Now, it'd be fun if here at the Psychological Foundation of yesteryear, where this unit is being held, it would be quite a bit of fun if we had some of the equipment which was here once. The stimulus response equipment. What we could do is put somebody on one of these stimulus response machines and find out how long it would take him to press a button after he saw a light flash, and give him some HC and show you how long it would take him to press the button after the light flash. And it would be astonishing to you to see communication in action. Because in essence, that's communication. The light communicates to the Thetan, and the Thetan then directs that the button be pushed and pushes the button. I don't care if he's in a body or if he's in a puppet or in a doll or anything else, that's all that's going to push that button for you. And so we'd have the interesting condition of the light communicating to the Thetan and the Thetan communicating to the button. So we've got a two-way channel, which is the first thing we drew there. All right, how fast is that two-way channel? It's as fast as it isn't automatic. Direct. That's a direct ratio. It's as fast as it isn't automatic. Inverse ratio. The more electricity that enters into a communication line, the slower the line is. Now, in Western Union telegraph operation, you get more and more relays entering into the line, and apparently your system, as it becomes more and more automatic, becomes faster. And that is not the case if you were to examine the actual length of time it took for the message to go through this automatic machinery. You would find out that it was exceeding longer and longer and longer a straight wire problem. You know, if we just had a click going in at one end of the wire and a click coming out at the other end of the wire, it'd be quite fast. But as we put in relays and things to receive it and things to bap and unbap and things to connect and unconnect and dials to go and all that sort of thing, the more stuff that goes into that line, the longer it's going to take that electronic impulse to come down. Well, that's purely mechanical. But that's what MEST does. MEST puts time into a communication line. There isn't any communication line time in a Phaeton. A Phaeton does not consider communication line time. He is instantaneous. And the more MEST then that we enter into, or the more circuits, or the more wire, you see, it takes an actual finite time for an electrical impulse to travel a foot of electrical wire. It takes time for it to do so. And that time itself is communication lag, and time, when applied to communications, gets very interesting. A star blows up out here a few light years away, and a million years later, why, we see the star blow up. Oh, boy. Now, a Phaeton, with no dependency upon MEST and no great agreement with MEST at all, would have seen the star blow up the instant it blew up. And so we get these strange things that are unaccounted for back down the track where the fellow knows something is going to happen. Well, the funny part of it is it's all an instantaneous problem anyway. And so the Phaeton can receive messages before they are sent, MEST-wise. It's instantaneous. Now, that shouldn't exceed your understanding very far at all. If the Phaeton is always in unit time, he's always in unit time, whether the year is 1,000 or the year is 2,000, and all you're getting there is a shift of particles, and if MEST itself and the co-motion of these particles is itself time, then you see if there's no co-motion of particles, there's no time for the Phaeton. It's very simple. So, naturally, what happened to you in the year 2000? You get this? I mean, what happened to you in the year 2000? Happened to you, that's all. It will happen to you. What happened to you will happen to you. Because it is happening to you, because it hasn't happened to you yet, because it's happened to you already. I mean, tenses just don't make sense. You just throw tense in the English language, just throw it out the window, because it doesn't make any sense to anybody. So therefore, you start running past and future as blocks out of a Phaeton, and of course his reaction time starts up, and his communication time starts up like that. And as you enter MEST in, he becomes more and more anxious about the past and future. You see, he becomes more and more anxious about the past, more and more anxious about the future, because he thinks that he has to wait for the particles to move before he can have. His havingness then depends entirely upon the motion of the particles around him. But of course, a Phaeton can mock up something which can endure a billion years or endure a split instant. It just doesn't matter which. He would have it. You see that? Conway over here gives a long, heartfelt sigh. Well, therefore, a mock-up not made out of MEST energy and not perceived in MEST space is itself either timeless or a split instant of time.
Who's
this? This doesn't matter which you said it. You can actually find the mock-ups which you made 8 billion years ago. Quote, sitting right around you, unquote. Because here, then, we get the problem of distance. If we're not using mesh space, if we've tailored up our own universe, why, it doesn't have this identical time lag, because you haven't set it up on the same co-motion of particles. But, of course, at this point, we go adrift, and we go off into theory, and we go off into an awful lot of things, and we're not interested in that. The point is that an engram can stay in suspension, which is the only point I'm trying to make, because it hasn't happened, and now will happen. An engram is happening. See, that operation that you're in, you're still in the operation. I just wanted to encourage you this morning, make you feel better. It hasn't stopped happening. Just because mess said it did, but you dive over from this operation. You want this operation not to happen anymore, so you say, well, I'm an old pal of mess. Yes, sir, the physical universe. Yeah, the particles have moved on. They have not. Now, as far as the actual operating chair and the motion of the fellow doing the operation and all of this sort of thing and the position of your mess body, yeah, this is all composed of messed particles. You understand that? So the particles have changed pattern, but all you're interested in is the thought aspect of this. And if you're interested in the thought aspect of this operation, it is happening. See? Because as far as you're concerned, why, it's happening, that's all. It never will be otherwise. It always is happening. So you decide that's the best thing in the world for you to do, then, is to get lots of distance between you and that operation, and that's why fellas start running. He was unwilling to do a duplication at that point. So when he makes mesh his ally, he no longer wants to be at that point. All this will come very clear, but a little bit later on in this course, I want you to listen to this tape again, and you will wonder, what the hell was I confused about? Simple. One of the things, the misapprehension under which you're laboring, is that theta has a position. Theta makes positions and can view from any position. And you're just as much 1,000 feet back of your head as you are in your head any day of the week. There's no difference between this. Therefore, when you say somebody's in his head, this gets very silly. You know, a fellow says, this is very silly. He's in his head. Well, he's also 1,000 feet back of his head. It all comes down to what is he looking at? See, he's not looking at anything 1,000 feet back of his head. He's looking at things in his head. In other words, he has geographically located his viewpoint. All that takes is merely a conviction that he's in his head. That's all it requires. Now, you can get the equal conviction, and again, if we had some of the equipment around here, such as blackjacks and PDH equipment that's used in the science of psychology, it would be very easy for us to demonstrate this clearly. You simply hit somebody over the head hard enough, you know, and he knows he's there. He's received that impact. In other words, he notices a fast change of mist. And he decides that he can feel this, and he's decided an awful lot of things. Well, he would be more convinced he was in his head if he were hit in the head, wouldn't he? Well, if we were to dope him up a little bit so that he were a bit drugged up and he were, let us say, in a state of high recipiency, we were to take him and put him in one corner of the room, and then we were to take a basketball, and we were to take a blackjack, and we were to start hitting this basketball in the other corner of the room. He's sitting in one corner, basketball's in the other corner. We were to start hitting this basketball, and let's concentrate, just looking at the basketball, you see, and swearing and damning this fellow by name as we hit the basketball, he would get into the basketball. Because he's in the basketball in the first place, as well as in his head. Because there's no size involved here. And see, it gets a very, very interesting problem. But he can make up his own universe and say its size is so-and-so and so-and-so, and then he becomes very comfortable. His mock-ups are far better. His running concepts far better in space which he himself makes than space which he has borrowed from the mess universe. Now, you'll tell one boy, and I'm sorry to have to throw this point in because on space, because one or two of you will be confused about it a little bit later on. But one fellow puts up in this room, he puts up eight balls in this room, and they're oriented against the corners of this room, you see. And they're oriented perfectly, and he thinks he's made some space. No, he hasn't. He's put up eight balls. In order to make some space, he has to make the postulate that he's making some space, and then he puts it up without any regard to mesh universe units. And he has made his own space. Now, in the latter space, it's very easy for him to make mock-ups. And in the earlier, it's not easy for him to make mock-ups. He might as well have forgotten to put up the eight balls, because he just put up eight balls in a room. But where did he put them up? Well, he put them up at the front of the room, and they're in such and such a relationship to the corner. In other words, he oriented his anchor points against mess. He let mess tell him where to put his anchor points. Therefore, people who put anchor points around the body and orient the anchor points by the body don't make space. Even though they're still in their body, if they'll simply close their eyes and merely put up eight anchor points from where they are viewing them, they will have made their own space. You see, it's totally a matter of orientation from self. And the orientation of self is simply that viewpoint which one happens to be using. There is nothing more simple than for a fellow to duplicate himself any place in the universe. Because he isn't any place in the universe, because he is every place in the universe. Any one of you immediately answers up to the definition that has been given, the anthropomorphic self, titled God. Any one of you, because you're everywhere, omniscient and omnipresent and omnibus and everything. Well, that doesn't mean that you're infinitely large. It doesn't mean you're as big as the mesh universe. It doesn't mean you're as small as the mesh universe. You see, what we're boxing with and what makes all this, you can make these terrifically incomprehensible remarks, is because all language is oriented against mess. Language is defined by mess, so the second we start talking about these things with mess language, it becomes balderdash. You can say, I guess I will have eaten lunch a couple of hours from now last year. And it makes just as much sense as anything else you would say in mess language, because the element of time is entered by the co-action, co-motion of particles. And you're not a particle, and thought isn't a particle, beingness isn't a particle, and time is an idea of where the particles are located. You want to know why this fellow gets into a screaming fit and the guilt comes over him overpoweringly about something he did someplace or another? Well, gee whiz, to all intents and purposes, he's doing it that moment. It isn't that he has a picture of it which he's running out. He can make a picture of it and then run out the picture of it. It's whether or not he's afraid of it. And the running of an engram was much less the problem of smoothing out energy than it was the problem of demonstrating to an individual that he could experience something again safely. It reconfirms to him continuously that he can survive anything. And as a result, he then changes his attitude toward existence. And he thinks he doesn't have to carry that somatic anymore, and he doesn't have to do this, and he doesn't have to do that. So your therapy in Dianetics was simply aimed towards showing an individual that he could do it again, and it wasn't necessary for him to brace himself all the time for fear it would happen again. He was all the time saying, it mustn't happen again, it mustn't happen again, and over on this side, on pleasure moments, it must happen again, it must happen again. And of course, he couldn't make either one stick. And in this confused state, you could run out engrams. The actual picture you ran out, however, he made at the instant you ran it out. It was made by an automatic machine. The person present has an engram. If you want to call an engram a piece of mist. You know, let's call this disc here an engram. See, because it's a mass of energy and so forth. Well, it would drift along in time. Now, I've changed its position, you see. Something that you could change the position of. It's all that sort of thing. All right, let's go a little bit further now. You don't have this engram if this is an engram. See, it isn't a mass of energy which you would have in your pocket and which would then get out and rub across your face in some fashion or another and destroy. What you would have to do with this, quote, package of engrams, unquote, would have an engram. You'd have to have an automatic machine that built it all the time and rebuilt it all the time. And in the absence of such an automatic machine that kept building it all the time, you wouldn't have one. Can you see that? If you've got a pretty markup from the year 1860, you've got a pretty markup from the year 1860, that's all. You got it then because you knew you had it. You'd have it again here because you knew you had it again. You follow this closely? You just know you have it, so you have it. But you'd have to, actually, to have substance to it, you'd have to rebuild it again. Now, it so happens that a thetan can do this. He can build it again. Now, he can go further than this. He can go further than this. He can actually build a piece of mist. And by nailing it into the relation of these particles, have it age and do everything else that these particles do, as long as he makes it in relationship to and in complete agreement with messed universe particles, it'll go along as a piece of the messed universe. So, are you making a markup in your own universe, or are you making a markup in the messed universe? If you're making a markup in the messed universe, it'll age and deteriorate and nail down and so forth, and you put it down in the corner of the street down here, a block away, and it's right there, it's on the concrete, and there it sits, and so forth. Well, you come back 1,000 years from now, and the concrete might have gone away, but that markup will have aged only to the degree that the energy which you actually hung up there in connection with mist energy would have aged. You see that there's a difference here. Now, I'm not talking in contradictions. I'm not talking in contradictions for several reasons. Nobody else agree very much to your mock-ups. Therefore, you have no responsibility towards somebody else with regard to your mock-ups. You can do very much what you please with them. And when somebody says they can see them, then you get a little bit upset because that limits your ability to do what you please with them. If enough people stood around and agreed they could see them, it would materialize, theoretically. But all this, why? Because you are going from a standpoint of knowingness. You know you communicate. You know there is a distance. You know there is a particle. You know there is a pocket. You know there is your own universe. You know these things and that thing. And all we have to establish to wind the guy up scale again is just to discover his pattern of agreement. And if we discovered his pattern of agreement, we've also discovered his patterns of communication and his feelings of affinity all the way up the line. Because we have to, quote, backtrack over the agreement in order to undo the problem, merely because he has a vested interest in life. No matter how bad off he thinks he is, he still has a vested agreement which he wants to keep agreed with to some degree. So you have to be able to chip this off for him, you know, kind of break it up at the edges a little bit and straighten it out and restore to him enough fluidity so that he can reestablish his agreements without at the same time wiping out his vested interest in the mess universe. You see that? And so we're up against the problem of happiness. We could process a free-clear theoretically by simply making him change his mind. And we would put him back in the same state he was in the year zero. But he changed his mind. Well, the only reason he won't change his mind is because he feels he has a vested interest. It's very remarkable. Some fellow starts to commit suicide and he bangs himself up one way or the other, and by golly, almost uniformly, he's on the verge of death, but he's recovering just slightly, you know, and he's going to die anyway. But boy, the mess universe turns on real bright, and he turns on real bright, and boy, does he want to live. You've never seen the surge toward life that an individual gets when he really knows he's going to die. It all gets so pretty. It's rather pathetic, even to go down the emergency wards of hospitals in big cities and watch people brought in who have committed suicide, and you'll find the same story, guy after guy after guy after guy. His vested interest is very great. Suicide didn't solve it, as he was concerned, but he thought it would. Suicide is occasioned by the fact that people think they only live once. You know, they think they can destroy themselves, and they fought this destroying themselves till they close terminals with it. And then they think they're going to wipe themselves out utterly. In such a way, death becomes very convincing to an individual, and he forgets his past, and he forgets that he's lived before, and all that sort of thing, merely because he's lost all his vested interests suddenly, you know? Everybody in the mesh universe, everybody in this agreed-upon plane has agreed at this particular time that when a fellow's dead, he no longer owns his possessions. In wills, you can only go so far in writing a will to dictate what's going to happen to your possessions. The law limits it quite sharply. Freakish wills are very easy to undo. You simply say the man has exceeded his rights. What's his rights? His rights is to handle and control his property after death. He doesn't have that right. And so we've agreed on this in all different directions. Now, I haven't gotten you too far adrift, because you will begin to realize, as you sit there after a while, that we're talking about knowingness, and that we can go on and talk the longest chain of this and that, and comparisons in this and that direction that you could possibly think of. I mean, you just go on and on and on and on and on with this stuff. I mean, we could talk for a year, 2 years, 3 years of strange comparisons and idiosyncrasies and oddities and tenses and so on, and we would get no place. Because we're talking about something which doesn't have anything more than knowing that it has. If it knows it has, it has. If it knows it doesn't have, it doesn't have. If it knows something exists, it does exist. But everyone here has a tremendous responsibility toward everyone else. And so we've all agreed mutually upon this and upon that and so forth. So we take these things apart very gently. Thus, when we don't run things by brackets, we don't run out former agreements. And when we leave the bracket alone and forget to run things in brackets, the fellow's case hangs up. Why? Because we hung him up with his agreements with the past and with the people around him as to what he owns and what he doesn't own. And, of course, he doesn't change very much. See this? Well, now, if you consider time and the Thetan, you'll find out that there's a tremendous communication lag in MEST. We've agreed that there is. Sun explodes, a million years later we see it. Okay? The sun up here explodes, and it'll take an hour or two. I've forgotten how long it is. It's 3 hours, or it's something like that. No, what is it, 8 minutes? Yeah, 8 minutes, right. That's right. I keep forgetting what system I'm in. Anyway, this sun up here is quite close, but it'll still take quite a little while for us to find out. It'll take finite time. All right, now let's see what happens to a Thetan who wants to avert an accident at a distance. The reason why you don't believe in distance anymore is because you can't avert an accident at a distance. You've already agreed the mesh universe is here and the distances are so much and it takes particles so much time in order to travel from this spot to that. And then you see that a fellow you know who is a dozen light years away is about to fall in a well. You see this using photons let's just dream up some real space opera here. And you've got a televised screen in front of you. You know, it's a televisio. And you see that another ship of the fleet's about to crash, something of the sort, and your brother's on that ship. And, boy, right away you say, to hell with this. And you simply appear or materialize in that area and put enough beams on that ship to cushion its fall. Now, that would be all very well. You actually have in your power to do that. You can change particles and suddenly shift agreements like that, but you'd be too late. By the time you put a beam on the ship, it would have crashed. And so it would look to you that by putting a beam on the ship, it crashed. It would look to you like you were assisting an accident. Well, do you know what sound does? Sound travels at 1,100 feet per second. The bullet of a modern rifle reaches you a long time before the report of the gun. 1,100 feet per second, bullet of a modern rifle travels at least 2,800 feet per second. That's a military rifle. And so it takes a long time for the report to reach you. The bullet got there in a hurry. And then after you're shot and you're already falling, why, you hear the gun go. They're two different communication speeds. Communication by sound, communication by bullet. Well, you actually had no communication speed between you're standing there ready to be shot, and there's no communication lag between the moment the trigger's pulled clockwise and you're standing there clockwise. Now, if your level of knowing this was very good, you would know when the trigger was going to be pulled. You see, there's no difference between those two things thought-wise. You could actually be over there and be back at the gun faster than the bullet could travel from the gun to you. Now, the funny part of it is you could know when the trigger was being pulled and duck. And then it would take a while for the particle to get to you, and you wouldn't be there anymore, and there you bite, and therefore you get the unkillable soldier. He knows which direction what's going. Communication lag. There is a present time in the meshed universe that's going to baffle some of you, so prick up your ears. We're not talking past tenses and future tenses now. There is a present time. If you stopped all particles throughout this universe in the same instant, and then inspected all of them, you would find every single one of them was in the present time that you stopped them in. You see that? If you stopped all the particles in the universe and then inspected them, you'd find out where they all were at this instant that you stopped them. Now let's stop them at present time instant. Therefore, it's present time all over the universe at the same unit instant. So you just stop all particles, and you look at them, and there's present time. All right, a person gets confused about present time simply because of this. A star explodes, and a million years later, he sees it. He isn't stopping all particles, or he isn't looking at all particles simultaneously. He's looking at the particles and the communication lag, because he's going to take the particles from the exploding sun that long to reach him. You see this? The particles are going to take time to get to him. Well, now, if he depends upon MEST for all of his communications, he isn't going to know about the exploding sun until a million or 2 years have gone by that the light's reaching. But if his level of knowing this is great enough so that he can be anywhere in the universe he wants to be in the same instant, then it is the greatest of ease. He knows that the sun explodes at the moment it explodes. And so, again, we get communication time lag. The causes of communication time lag, then, consists of time itself, the length of time, or the distances it takes particles to travel through MEST. The more an individual agrees with MEST, which is to say the more he depends upon MEST, the greater time lag he himself has and the less ability he has to know. Therefore, agreement with MEST is very poor. Once you've depended on MEST to bring you all your messages and you've depended on it to do everything, why, it gets very bad. Now, there's a test of this. You can do this with a pre-clear, great ease. You can have him mark up this room as this room, and then mark up this room as this room, and 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 keep that up for several hours on just a duplication of this room at the instant that the room is in, you know, and never let him vary a factor about the room and insist that he duplicates this room exactly and so forth, and we find out that the therapy hit an interesting peak. It would go up, and he would get interested in it from a standpoint of duplication, and then after a little while, it would begin to fall off. And then all of a sudden, you'd find him pretty flat. Why? You forced him to agree with MEST. Now let's make him duplicate this room, and then duplicate this room with calico walls. And then duplicate this room a little bit bigger, and then duplicate it a little bit smaller. Now make him duplicate it a little bit bigger than his own concept for this room. And a little bit smaller than the concept he had of this room. And then duplicate this room in the year 1770. And then duplicate this room this way and duplicate it that way. And that is to say, make him set up the room and then get a duplicate of it. Make him set up the room with calico walls and then make him get a duplicate of this room with calico walls. And you keep on doing this, and next thing you know, his perception's going way up. Why? Because you're breaking him away from agreeing with Ness. And it is agreement with Ness which gave him the communication lag and gave him the idea he could only be in one place at one time. How does the Thetan duplicate himself? You know, every one of you has the potentiality of granting beingness to another point of space, which is you, and then knowing in that point of space. Every one of you has this. And this, in essence, would be the duplication of your own personality. Now, you could do this well enough so that other point of space, while you stood right where you were, it'd merely be a scarcity of your attention that inhibited you from doing this. You could stand right here in this room and duplicate yourself in a point of space over at the westward hole. And while you were still here, fully knowing, you could be in the westward hole, fully knowing. See, therefore, sending somebody around in change of space is not sending a unit dot of something to here or there, but is making a person know he is over another pattern of particles. Now, we get the shifting of location is in itself communication. So you let, quote, Nest communicate to you continuously. Well, that makes you have to duplicate Nest in order to receive the communication of a Nest. And if an individual thinks there's danger in duplicating this communication, in being this communication, he resists it, while he eventually plows in and obsessively becomes it. He begins to obsessively communicate with Ness, so that he sees a picture on the wall and he'll have a flat feeling on his face. Very flat feeling. It's a picture on the wall. And you want to know what these strange GE somatics are. They're quite often merely in the field of mesmerism. The GE is mesmerized by Ness. He's hit it too often. And he's no longer able to maintain his own identity well enough. So he just duplicates Nest obsessively. He doesn't like it. He fights it. And Nest is not something he wants anything to do with. And as a consequence, the funny feeling he's got in his face is the picture on the wall, or the chalky feeling in a rock or something. If somebody who's kind of bad off can be walking along the street or something and then feel a little bit bad. And then they'll attribute it to the past, or something they ate, or something of the sort, where, as a matter of fact, it was a rotten fish hanging out someplace. They just duplicated it. And it's quite amusing to you as an auditor that when you are auditing somatics or ill health, you have many choices of eradication of the somatic. First is to eradicate, of course, obsessive duplication on the part of the body. That's first. And that's done in several ways. But the next one, just in auditing, you see somebody in the service station, he doesn't feel very good. He hasn't been well lately. And so forth. And you have immediately another choice. What's he duplicating around this service station? That's his immediate environment. Well, how do you solve this? You just tell him to look at it. That's all. You make him look at it, and as soon as he really starts looking at it, he is duplicating by consent. And as soon as he duplicates by consent, he isn't duplicating by fighting. So by duplicating by consent, he then stops obsessively duplicating and merely starts to consciously duplicate. In other words, you cut out the automaticity of obsessive duplication. Here we get automaticity of communication. An obsessive duplication would be an automaticity. It would be something without his consent, something that would go on operating hour after hour, day after day. He'd be doing this all the time. Now let's get it over to a point where we're getting into consent to be the point B on our communication line. See, we're getting into consent to be the receipt point. And we make him intentionally become the receipt point. And we have done just what I said yesterday. We've said, all right, now look, whenever a preclear has something strange happen, make him do it again. And the item will fall under his control. And a second it goes under his control, he, of course, is no longer plagued with this automaticity because he put it there in the first place, so you make him take it over again. You make him knock out the separateness of it and the forgetter mechanism in it by making him do it. So if this bat is obsessively duplicating, then let's run this sort of a task on him. Let's just simply, without going into anything that looks to him like necromancy, like, all right, now make your body stand there like a gas pump would be a thought. All right, now make it stand there like a water bucket. Now make the inside of it feel like a water bucket. Okay? Now make it feel like an air hose. And so on. And we could do this until all of a sudden he found one that was very nerve-wracking to him, and then we just make him be that by choice one way or the other, and all of a sudden that automaticity key out, and he feel good. But that's an extreme thing, you see. That would look too much like necromancy to him. He wasn't particularly indoctrinated into this. He'd think that you were playing tricks on him or something. So you would tell him, actually, though, just look around now. And he starts looking around. Of course, he is now, with his consent, being receipt point. You ask him to actually look at the service pump. You ask him to look at the air hose. You ask him to look at the water bucket. You ask him to look at that. And you just keep asking him, well, to what does he attribute his cause? Or anything that will put his attention, you know, the cause of his trouble. Is there anything around here you don't like? It's a good way to go about it. And make him look at this. And, well, what is there about the gas pump you don't like exactly? Oh, he'd never noticed before. It has handles. Well, in order to look at something, he has to duplicate it with his consent. And so it'll key out his automaticity. Before he's looked around very long, why the automaticity of obsessive duplication of some object which he despises in the vicinity ceases. So you've got the present time problem solved. Now, automaticity can be keyed out by making a person be cause. This is automaticity of perception. Make the person be cause, or at the cause, or a point of the line. Well, now, the way you do that is, all right, get a mock-up of a gas pump. This is all creative processing. Okay? And the other one is the receipt point. Be perfectly at ease about receiving something. Well, now, you'll find many people have fought against being the receipt point and have obsessively put themselves into a situation of being cause. In order to keep from being a receipt point, the fellow says, I'm going to be cause. I'm going to be cause. I'm going to be a reader. I'm something or other. And I'm going to be cause. I'm going to be cause. And therefore, I don't have to be a receipt point. Well, of course, the communication line has two ends. And this fellow nailed himself down in his head like he had spikes in it. Because he is at the cause point, and he won't go around to the receipt point. If he won't go around to the receipt point, then every automatic machine he has which duplicates goes into completely random action and becomes his enemy. Every automatic machine he has then becomes his randomity. And boy, the weirdest, strangest, most horrible things happen. Why, of course, everything is inexplicable. Because any automatic machine that he has at point B, not at point B, but any automatic machine he has which duplicates, in any way, as a receipt point, of course goes into full operation as his randomity. So just exactly 50% of his basic communication setup goes into action against him. He'll only be cause point. He'll only be cause point. He'll only be cause point. All right. Now, what do we do with this fellow? Well, we just make him look around. If we just do that, just identify what in the environment is your exact trouble. You know? All we're doing is making him duplicate with his choice, with his consent. We're taking at least sight over. Now, it's a little harder to take sound over because you don't get sounds, random sounds occurring at the request of the auditor. But you do get random sights occurring at the request of the auditor, pretty much. I mean, sights of objects and so forth. So sound is a little harder to process, and for that reason, most auditors leave it alone and leave the case hung up on it. They'll leave a case hung up on sound. Or they'll try to run backtrack. In other words, to get sound. Well, let's see, let's get the time you were listening to the symphony, now be the symphony. Of course, the only way a guy can ever listen to a symphony is to be the symphony. The only way you can ever receive any communication is to be that thing which is communicating to you. That's duplication. Now we've got automaticity and randomity and communication all tied up here together. And we've got duplication, which is much more important, tied up here together. The inability of a precursor to remain in one place is tied up here too. He's got to chase off to some new place all the time. He can't stay in one place. He can't duplicate, in other words. And this is very interesting, but it's a little bit more than interesting. It's the stuff you're dealing with. Duplication, communication, automaticity, randomity. Cause and effect. And beingness. And then space, viewpoint of dimension. You got it. Now, when an individual obsessively has to duplicate something, his space, of course, goes down to nothing. And he has as much space as he's perfectly willing and easy to duplicate. You see, he can just duplicate all over the place with great ease, and as far as retaining his individuality, he can do this. As a matter of fact, the better he can duplicate, the more individual he can become. You see, by that, because duplication depends upon an ease of mind. He can set himself up in individuality or have this individuality and do most anything he wants. As long as he isn't obsessively closing terminals with the rest of the universe. Now, what's closed terminal? Closed terminal is when B snaps against A, and B and A coincide, and that is identification. And this is obsessive duplication. Identification and obsessive duplication are the same thing. The terminals snap together. No space. When we say an individual has no space, we are saying immediately his communication lines are absent. That is to say, all of his A points coincide with his B points. We are saying as well, the C, or cause, and the effect are close together too. So that an individual has overt motivator upset. Okay? He thinks he will suffer from everything which he causes because his B and A have collapsed. So therefore, what is cause is effect, is cause is effect, is cause is effect. You see, he is the victim, he is himself. He just flipped back and forth between these two things like a shuttlecock. And this, of course, depends upon how much he fights duplication. And if he fights duplication hard enough, he'll get so he duplicates anything, and that if he were to stick a pin in anything, he would feel the pin in himself. He would go into an obsessed motor report with everything, and there he'd be. And the way he gets into that is refusing to duplicate. Now, what happens to this on the second dynamic? His sexual ability declines. What happens on the third dynamic? Well, he gets buttered all over the universe on the third dynamic. You see, obsessively doesn't want to be a group, so he just becomes obsessively any part of a group. And what happens on the fourth dynamic? Well, he closes terminals with man in the first place, and then he becomes man. What happens on the fifth dynamic? He would become any animal he happened to see. Or he would run away from any animal he happened to see. A guy disperses and condenses and disperses and condenses. In other words, the line gets unbearably long, and then they get collapsed, and then they get unbearably long, and then they get collapsed, except the condition worsens. What's this got to do with havingness and terminals? It has everything to do with it. An individual cannot exteriorize unless he can put some space between two terminals, namely the terminal he's going to occupy at the moment and the terminal the body's occupying. If an individual is fighting the body, why, he snaps into its head. All right, so we get the fellow who's going to do a bunk. He's going to shove off for Arcturus. We say to him, all right, I'll be 2 feet back of your head, and by golly, he's 2 light years away and still going. Well, that's one of these lines that is lengthening. See? That's just an obsessive lengthening between these two. Well, that'll be immediately succeeded by an obsessive collapse of the two lines, and he won't be able to get out of his head. So the next time you tell him to get out, he's not going to be able to budge. In other words, he can't handle space between terminals. That's all that's wrong with him. Tired diagnosis. Why? He has set it up automatically for something else to handle the space between terminals. He isn't handling it, something else is. So you just make him handle space between two terminals. You make him put space between two terminals for a while and he'll be able to step out of his head. I mean, by this, you'd have an ashtray here and a package of cigarettes here, you see, and we say, all right, now put a foot of space between those two terminals. Now put no space between them. Now put a foot of space and do it intentionally every time. Now put a yard of space between them. Now put them right close up together. Now put an exact inch. And each time, make him do it right down to the last tiny notch of accuracy, you see. Make him even get a ruler and measure it off and so on. And we just keep putting more space and less space and so forth. And then have him put random spaces between the two terminals. Make him make a package of cigarettes skid that way and that go that way and say how much space is there. Now I'm going to put random space between them. Now I'm going to take lucky space out of them or something of the sort. And random space, well, they didn't quite go together, you know. We do exercises of that character. And that itself will simply exteriorize a fellow. Now, what are we talking about when we're talking about all this? We're talking about essentially livingness. Don't lose sight of that. We're not talking about a flock of mechanics. But what are the mechanics of livingness? The most intimate mechanics of livingness which we have, and out of which we can get the best results in processing. And so snap people up the line, put them in good condition, make them free, make them cheerful, make them good companions and good groups. How can we do this? We use processes then which remedy, enhance, better, or utilize the conditions which I have just outlined to you. Now you actually have in your hands at this moment all the component parts that we have to have to process people. Just in the lectures I've given you right up from when we started this course, right up till now. And this is what, the third, fourth day? All right. That's all the material we need. I've given it to you. You've had it. Now, you don't think that this is very much material. You think this is far too much material. The only thing about it is this. These are precision data. That graph I just gave you there on communication is a precise graph. I mean, we're not just giving you an illustration of what communication is. So you just get your sights completely off of, well, he's giving us examples when I'm giving you a law or a definition. You just get your sights off of that, and you get that over on the fact that it is a rigid law. It does operate that way. And you erect thinkingness on the top of that law, and boy, you'll be an auditor. And in addition to that, you can instruct people in the slightest and strangest or the most roundabout ways. And they will ask you the most confounding questions about what you're doing. You've got the basic law. How does it apply to that? Why, zing, there's the answer. There's nothing to that. You see that? So if you get yourself a very, very good grounding in just the material we've had right up to this point, you're set, because I'm not going to introduce another single cockeyed new thing on you. We're just going to know these things better and better and better and better. And processing our problem is imposing space. Or taking space out from between two terminals. Havingness itself is a problem of terminals. The guy gets into his condition where he believes point A and point B each has mass. You know, and then the mass discharges and makes an automatic communication system, which gives him energy. And that is a motor. It's an automatic communication system between terminal A and terminal B. And it's just an automatic interchange. And after he sets this up automatically, after that you exteriorize and he feels degraded. Why? He depends on something else to generate the energy for him, to generate the communications for him. And so, he himself can't generate anything. He can't be caused, so he can't generate energy. So when you get him out of his head, you've made him part from that thing which has most fed him energy. He's used energy from two masses. Well, he's actually creating the mass energy that he's using. Now we get into the subject of time, we get into the subject of havingness. People get along to the point where every instant as it goes by robs them of that instant. Every sight they see is robbed. They lose it the next instant. And they get to a point where they don't think they'll get a new sight and nothing else will appear. And so they've lost the whole universe and so they can't perceive, so they lose their space. Well, what's this? This is simply a matter of there is the individual and there is the motion of the particle, and there is he trying to communicate with these particles. But he conceives them to be going by someplace. He thinks he's moving. The main trouble is he thinks he's a particle. And he's shifting around and being reflected on by these things as they flick on by. Therefore, he's losing his havingness all the time. What's havingness got to do with this? Havingness is merely the matter of the manufacture of the particles he sees. He's making all this stuff, and he's making it at the speed of light, which is to say he's marking and unmarking the universe at the speed of light. That's how fast he's marking up things and unmarking them. And when he is no longer able to mark up and unmark and mark up and unmark and mark up and unmark at that speed, he doesn't see things. So he doesn't know. Your level of knowingness is tremendously high. All you really have to do is know that everything is all right, and you'll be all right. I'm not going to introduce new material. I'm just showing you that havingness, just so that you later on, when I bring it up, and bring up the degradation because of loss of masses, won't suddenly think that this exceeds communication and exceeds everything we've been talking about. It's all part of the same package. All right, and just so that I can say with great honesty that you've had it. Now, your task before you, it's not really a terribly difficult task, actually. The assimilation and application of the principles which I've given you right up to this time, the alignment of them and matching them up to what you know and seeing that they work, that's all that remains for us in this unit. Okay.